Okay, hoping that's on. Just while we're sorting out sound levels, if you're new to CCE and you just want to find out a little bit more about us, please come and say hi. Be lovely to meet you. But also, we've got the final evening of CCE Discovery Evenings this evening, 7 o'clock, just down the side entrance. So if you've been coming to those, be lovely to see you there again. And if you haven't come to any of them, tonight's a really practical evening, but you'd be very welcome. It's about how you can get involved, who's who, how do we kind of work, and who to go and speak to if you're interested in different areas. Chris Hall's doing that. He's away down in the Lake District this weekend for Lisa's 21st birthday bash, but racing up the M6, hopefully almost as we speak, to come and be there tonight for that, and I'll be there as well. So 7 o'clock tonight if you want to come. Just come down this side entrance just there and ring the buzzer on the green door and we'll let you in. Okay. So this is sermon number 5 on peacemaking, part of this epic Sermon on the Mount series that I'm doing, which started in January 2009, and we've done an amazing 37 verses, and we're nearing towards having done 42. The first one I did was back on September the 11th this year, which was the 10-year anniversary of September 11, and the attacks on the World Trade Center. And I seem to be picking Sundays which have some significance in terms of violence and conflict, as we are today. This is Remembrance Sunday. It wasn't intentional, it was just the pattern that we picked, and particularly in relation to when Colin was around and when I was around. But I just find that interesting. I want to read a quote that I read a couple of weeks ago as we started looking at these three, there's actually four, but we'll come to that next time, transforming initiatives around peacemaking that are designed to break the cycle of escalating conflict. And this is a quote from a Catholic priest. And so we're looking at the courage of peacemaking. We have assumed the name of peacemakers, but we have been, by and large, unwilling to pay any significant price. And because we want the peace with half a heart, half a life and will, the war, of course, continues, because the waging of war by its very nature is total. But the waging of peace by our own cowardice is partial. Of course, let us have peace, we cry. But at the same time, let us have normalcy. Let us lose nothing. Let our lives stand intact. Let us know neither prison nor ill repute nor disruption of ties. There is no peace because there are no peacemakers. There are no makers of peace because the making of peace is at least as costly as the making of war. There is no peace. There are no makers of peace because the making of peace is at least as costly as the making of war. I just think that's an extraordinary quote, extraordinary accurate insight into the human condition. And I think Jesus calls us to walk this path of courageous peacemaking. So we've looked at the myth of redemptive violence. That was back on September the 11th. This lie that violence can bring peace, I believe. It's a lie. That war brings peace.
We'll maybe finish with Jesus' perspective on that at the end of this morning. We've looked at escalation of conflict. We've looked at some of the characteristics of how conflict escalates. I'm not going to rehearse all of those, but we looked at six different characteristics of escalation of conflict that we saw in one of the scriptural stories. We looked at Joseph and his brothers, but actually sociologists and people have looked at conflict and researched conflict and found, interestingly, that the same things that we read in these scripture stories are actually just found in conflict. So they're characteristics of how conflict escalates. We looked at that. And the last two times we've begun diving into how Jesus calls us to break these cycles of violence. So you have heard it said, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, lex talionis, this law of equal retribution that was a law that was given in the Old Testament to try and limit conflict. It's not wrong, it just doesn't go far enough. So Jesus says, But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone strikes you, my offering of that translation is do not resist evil with evil. Do not resist by evil means. He's not saying do not resist evil, but do not resist evil by evil means. Do not take revenge. Do not retaliate. And then we've got into, if someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. Alison, you always seem to be sitting in the prominent place here, so can I just borrow you again? So if someone strikes you on the right cheek, the only way to hit someone on the right cheek, Matthew's really specific here, it's the right cheek, the only way to do that was a backhanded slap like that. That was what masters did to slaves. It's what husbands did to wives in that culture. I'm not condoning that, but in that culture, the husband was the dominant one. So a husband would slap a wife as a subservient thing, and it's what parents did to children. And it was a sign of dominance. And so Jesus says, turn the other cheek. It's not actually about the physical pain of being slapped. It's more about the humiliation and the insult that is the key thing there. So Jesus says, turn the other cheek. It's not some kind of just be a doormat and just suck it up. He's actually saying, turn the other cheek. So if you turn the other cheek, the only way that I can strike somebody on the left cheek is with the fist. And that was a sign of what equals did. If I was equal to someone, I would strike them with a fist. If they were subservient to me, lower down, they weren't really human, then I would slap them on their right cheek with the back of my hand. You turn the other cheek, you're actually putting the person who's the offender, the hitter, thanks Alison, into a very difficult position because you're saying, you can hit me, but if you hit me, you're going to hit me as an equal. You're going to hit me recognizing that I'm a human being with dignity and value and worth. There is a vulnerability in turning the other cheek, absolutely, because you may get hit again. But if you get hit, you'll get hit in a different way. The humiliation has been taken away. It's absolutely brilliant. I think Jesus is brilliant here. And then we looked at, last time, we looked at if someone wants to sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And we sprung from that verse into the verse in Luke, which is the parallel verse. And there were two different scenarios that we were looking at last week. One, in Matthew, the scenario of the law court. Somebody is in debt. They've lost everything. They've lost everything, not because of their incompetence about the ability to actually manage their money, but because there is a pernicious, unjust society and system that just takes more and more money. And part of that was from the taxes of the Roman Empire that was just perniciously took taxes away from poor. And so you ended up in this cycle of escalating poverty almost. If you were poor, you just lost more and more and more and more until the only two things that you were left with was your tunic, which was your undergarments, and your cloak, which was also your duvet, which you slept under at night. Those are the only two things that this person is left with, and he is being sued for his tunic, his undergarments. It's probably a debtor's court. The implication of the verses is that actually this person really was in debt. So the person suing was right. He had the right to do it legally, but Jesus seems to be inferring that the system itself is unjust. So there was a legal right to sue, but there was not a moral right to sue. And so Jesus is saying, if somebody is wanting to strip away almost your last possession because of the unjust system in which you live in, then don't just give him your undergarment, take off your cloak too. And we looked last time, what that would have done meant was that this person was left naked in the law court. And the shame, in our culture, the shame is being naked, being seen naked in a public place, mostly, not always, but mostly. The shame in that culture was looking upon someone who was naked. And so we looked at Noah and his sons and the condemnation on one of his sons, Ham, who looked upon Noah's body when he'd had a bit too much to drink and was lying in his tent naked. The shame was upon the son, not upon Noah. And so by taking all your clothes off, you're exposing the unjust system which got this person into debt in the first place. You're saying, yes, you may have a legal right to do this, but there is a moral injustice that's going on here, and let's just expose it for what it really is. Again, Jesus is giving examples that are absolutely brilliant about resisting non-violently injustice. So the first one about slapping of the cheek is primarily about insult, and the second one is primarily about injustice. And it's about standing against injustice, but doing it in a non-violent way. That actually, I will look at this, but gives the possibility of change to the system. And then we come to this third one. If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. So we've heard this phrase, it's common in our culture. Go the extra mile. What does it mean in our culture? Work harder. Push yourself beyond the limit. Yeah, excellent, both of them. Do more than that is asked for you. Brilliant. I think those three probably actually fairly capture everything. Has anybody got anything different of what go the extra mile might mean? In our culture. So I think I just looked up on some dictionary definitions here. Try harder to please someone or get the task done correctly. Do more than one is required to do to reach a goal. To make more effort than is expected of you. To do more and make a greater effort. I think those are up on the next slide. So if you do a little internet search on Go the Extra Mile, you will find all kinds of businesses and companies and things that say, we go the extra mile in our work. We will really work hard for you. If you hire us to print your leaflets or change your tires on your car or whatever, we will go the extra mile. And so what they may not realize is that they're actually quoting the words of Jesus. But I want to suggest that they're using the words of Jesus in completely the wrong way from the way that Jesus actually meant them to be used. And you've probably got the pattern by now, I hope. Okay? There's going to be some kind of twist in this, isn't there? That's obvious. It's so obvious to the hearers of the day, but because it's clouded by 2,000 years of culture, it's harder for us to really understand. And so when we read this verse, go the extra mile, might be just do that little bit extra more. Do more than is really expected of you. Work harder. Sometimes we might use the phrase, oh, do you know, I've just really struggled in my relationship with so-and-so, but I've gone the extra mile, but there's nothing more I can do. It's like we've done more than really is expected of us, but I don't think that's what Jesus is really on about. And for us to understand that, let's just go back into the culture of the day to try and understand what was going on. So the place where they were was in under a military occupation. Imagine that the Second World War had not transpired in the way that it did transpire, and we were under enemy, as it were, occupation. Maybe it was Germany, maybe it was France, maybe there's another country that have their troops in our cities and this land, and we are under enemy occupation. That was the situation that was there in Palestine, and it was extremely unpopular in Israel. It was extremely unpopular in those days. And the other issue around the armies were they were actually a long way from home. So one of the things about armies when they're a long way from home is you need to keep supplies up. Food and supply chains and all the rest. And in our day and age, that's relatively easy because you just fly an aeroplane in and they land and they distribute all the food. But in that day and age, that was incredibly difficult. And so soldiers had to travel with all the stuff that they really needed. Now, if you were a very rich soldier or a very powerful soldier, you would probably have had your own personal slaves who would come along with you on your travels, and they would take all your belongings. And they would carry them as you marched all the way from Rome or Italy or wherever it was that you'd come from to Israel, which was many hundreds and thousands of miles away, when you could only walk a few miles every day. But for most soldiers, they had to carry their packs themselves, and all their weapons, and all their food, and everything else that there was needed. And they would have these enormously heavy packs that they would have to carry that were many, many kilos in weight. Somebody said that they were somewhere between 60 and 85 pounds, not including your weapons. And so what the soldiers tended to do was they would requisition other people. This was a practice that was first taken up in the Persian Empire, but was introduced by the Roman Empire. And they would recruit civilians, wherever they found them, to take their pack for them. And as you can imagine, this was extremely, even more unpopular than the occupation itself. So they'd be walking along the road, they'd find some poor unsuspecting civilian who was minding his own business, maybe he was cooking, she was cooking a meal for the family, or he was working in the fields, or he was doing some kind of job, or he was off to go and visit the family and down the street, down the road, and he'd go, "Ah, Lindsay, here's my pack, I want you to take it." Not "I want you," "you will." "Take this pack," and you would, they would force. And so we read here in the scriptures, if someone forces you to go 1 mile. There wasn't any kind of choice about this. You were forced to carry this pack to take it for the soldier. Now, this practice was abused enormously. In fact, all kinds of practices were abused enormously, and the local civilians were often abused by the soldiers. And so that meant that the soldiers were incredibly unpopular, and there were insurrections and all the rest. And so the Roman authorities started putting rules down about what you could and could not do. And one of the rules was you could only force someone to take your pack, guess how far? 1 mile. You were only allowed to say to Lindsay, "I want you to take my pack." Now, 1 mile is quite a long way with 60 to 85 pounds of pack, and then you've got to walk all the way back, and whatever he was doing would be lost at that point. But you were only allowed to force somebody to carry your pack for 1 mile. And if you read the histories, this particular practice was incredibly unpopular. There are stories of whole villages, when they heard that the Roman soldiers were coming, they'd just all run away and flee, because they didn't want to be told that they had to carry these packs for all the Roman soldiers. Probably wasn't just one Roman soldier either. It was probably a whole bunch of them all travelling together. So they would get whole families and whole villages and say, right, you're all going to take our packs and walk them this 1 mile. There are other stories of rich towns that would pay a considerable amount of money to make sure that actually the Roman soldiers didn't come and visit their town and force them to take their packs. It was an extremely unpopular practice. And there were penalties that the Romans started imposing for violations against the local civilian population. Now, it's not clear exactly what the penalties for violating this particular rule was, but more generally, the violations, there were loads of different kinds of violations, penalties for violation. It could be deprivation of pay, it could be a ration of barley instead of wheat. Not quite sure what the difference there would be, but presumably wheat is a little bit more nourishing or something. I've no idea. Maybe it makes bread. It could be a reduction in rank. Could be a dishonorable discharge, which would obviously have huge financial implications. It could be being forced to camp outside your fortifications, which would incur some level of danger, presumably. You could have to stand barefoot in public places, which would have some element of shame. But by far the most frequent punishment for violations of the rules governing how you were to treat the local civilian population was flogging. So, it was this context of Roman occupation that Jesus doesn't suggest driving a knife into the Roman soldiers. He doesn't, which there were religious leaders of the day that were really up for armed opposition to the occupation. Jesus doesn't suggest that. But I also want to suggest that Jesus doesn't suggest just sucking it up and doing it. So Jesus says, if somebody forces you to go 1 mile with this pack, go with him 2 miles. Just imagine the situation. The soldier is used to forcing people to take their pack, and when they've done a mile, they'd be like, right, put it down, and off they go. But one day, he gets hold of this local person who picks up the pack, takes it 1 mile, and when he gets to the mile marker, he says, no, let me take it another mile. Let me carry on taking your pack. Now, this put the soldier actually in quite a difficult position, because he was only allowed to force somebody to take it 1 mile. He could get into trouble if you take it 2 miles. He doesn't know quite what the consequences might be. He doesn't know. Then maybe there are other people around. Maybe they're not. Maybe you're going to tell. Maybe, oh, suddenly this soldier who's used to being the one that is powerful, in control, forcing people to do whatever he wants them to do, suddenly he is the one that is on the back foot. He is the one that is being confronted with the possibility that he could end up being in trouble for forcing somebody to go the extra mile when you were only allowed to go 1 mile. I think it's brilliant. Now, there is also a certain amount of humour here, which through 2,000 years of culture would be completely lost on us. But if you were a first century Jew, you'd probably be rolling around at laughing at this, at the absolute brilliance of what Jesus is suggesting. Ha! Huh? What a fantastic idea. These horrible soldiers, they force us to take their packs 1 mile. We hate this. Brilliant. We could take them 2 miles. Ah, And then just imagine that poor soldier. He's going to be... Yeah, well, let's not go there. Might be using that little teapot that Caroline had. He's going to be so scared. Suddenly, the oppressor, I want us to notice this, is on the back foot and not as powerful as he was when he first forced you to pick up the pack. And suddenly the person who is seemingly powerless because he is legally required to take that backpack for the first mile is suddenly very powerful. Not through violence, not through aggression, but just through the brilliant wisdom of Jesus. Is this making any sense? Sorry. My microphone fell off. So Jesus isn't encouraging people to build up merit in heaven. He isn't encouraging people to show real holiness or long-sufferingness or patience. He isn't asking people to do above and beyond the call of duty. He isn't asking people to kill people with kindness, as it were. This is what Walter Wink says. No, he's helping an oppressed people find a way to protest and neutralize an onerous practice despised throughout the empire. Jesus is asking people to find a way to non-violently confront injustice, dominance, power, and violence, but to do so in a way that doesn't meet violence with violence, that totally turns the tables, changes the dynamic, empowers the person who is oppressed, disempowers the person who is supposedly the one who is all powerful, and bring the possibility of change. I think it's fantastic. And so from last time, each of these have had these three elements in them. Each of these three examples, if we could go to that slide where it says breaks the cycle of violence. So the first thing is Jesus is always asking, or he's giving a scenario, he's giving a picture. If you do this, the first thing that will happen is it breaks the cycle of violence. It breaks this cycle of conflict that can so easily escalate. We've looked at how conflict escalates. And so Jesus, the first thing he's interested in is breaking this cycle of violence and conflict. The second thing is it changes the person who is offended from being powerless to being actually really quite powerful, or recognizing the power that they really have. Suddenly, they're no longer forced to do it, they're choosing to do it. And that is an immensely powerful thing when you choose to do something rather than forced to do something. It's partly about empowering the individual. And thirdly, it is confronting the other person with the injustice, with the dominance and the oppression that they are meeting on you, in a loving, generous, careful way that might possibly give them an insight into their behavior, that might possibly be a step towards change and repentance. In Luke's Gospel, this verse actually isn't there in Luke's Gospel, but turning the cheek and giving your cloak and tunic, although reversed, different scenario, robber on a road. Both of those are found in the context of loving your enemies. The next passage we get to in Matthew's gospel is loving your enemies. These are examples that Jesus gives us of ways in which we can completely change scenarios, situations that we find ourselves in. But at its heart, it's about loving the other person. It is about confronting them with their behavior. But it is also about loving and moving towards the other person that wants the best for them, that might possibly bring about change and repentance in them. And so these three things are always at work in each of these. So a lot of this stuff has been taken from a theologian called Walter Wink, and he talks about this Jesus' third way. And Jesus' third way from these particular verses has certain characteristics. Jesus isn't setting up a new law. He isn't saying if somebody slaps you on your right cheek, that's what you've got to do, turn your left cheek. Because most of us aren't faced with scenarios where soldiers come along and press gang us into taking their belongings for a mile down the road. I would very much doubt that any of us have been in that situation. But he is saying that in places, in situations where we face humiliation, in situations where we face injustice, and situations where we face an abuse of power, bullying, workplace, two examples that would come to mind straight away. In these situations, here's the kind of thing that you could have done 2,000 years ago, and he invites us to rethink what we might do in our situations, in the places of work, our families, our communities that we find ourselves today. I think that is enormously challenging to do. And I think what it does for me is it forces me to pray. Because I believe that the Holy Spirit is so creative that he will give us ideas and thoughts and ways of doing this. That as we come and pray and we say, God, there's this situation and I just don't know what to do here. I think he'll give us things that is about this third way. That isn't about fighting. It isn't about meeting oppression, injustice, domination, and humiliation with the same spirit. It isn't about retaliating. It isn't about returning it like for like or even more, which is our human tendency. It isn't just saying, well, I'll just suck it up. That's fine. I'm a Christian. I'll just, you know, I know somebody's being really bullying and rude at work, but I'm just going to suck it up because that's what Christians do. It's finding a third way that confronts what is being done, but does it in a loving way and changes the dynamic. And so Walter Wink suggests that there are a number of characteristics of things, and we've looked at some, and I want to add a few so we get a full list here of things that we can do, that characteristics of the way that we might go about doing these things in our situations today. So from the last two times, and these kind of spill over all of them, so they're not just restricted to one or t'other, they're probably in elements of all of them. Find a creative alternative to violence. I don't know about you, but if somebody is using their power to force me to do something, I really, really dislike that. And what actually rises up in me is a response of conflict and violence back again. What I want to do is probably do that verbally rather than physically, because we did the physical stuff in the playground, eh? Well, at least I did. Come on, I'm probably not the only one. Maybe that's more of a boy thing. But anyway. So in the playground, if somebody whacks you, you whack them back. We tend to grow out of that when we're adults. So if somebody bullies us, what rises up in me is something that's very aggressive verbally as a response. So it may not be violence in a physical sense, but it is violence in a verbal sense. And so Wink is suggesting that we find a creative alternative to violence, whether that's physical or verbal. We break the cycle of humiliation. Somehow we do something which is empowering, that is reconnects us again with our value and worth and dignity. We assert our own humanity and dignity as a person. We challenge the oppressor to see us in a new light in some way. I think in our culture, we often do that with words. One of the ways I think we can do this one is to actually talk about the impact that it's had, whatever it is, has had on us. That is a very vulnerable place to be, because you're probably sharing something quite vulnerable. But to actually say, when you said that, I felt this. This is what I felt. This is the effect that it had on me. They might go, oh, just grow up. Or get a skin. But actually what we're doing is we're asking them, we're requesting them, we're challenging them to see us in a new light, in our humanity, in our vulnerability. Turning the other cheek, taking off your cloak, going the extra mile is a place of vulnerability. We'll come to that just as I finish up. But we're challenging them to see us in a new light. We're meeting force with ridicule or humour, just laughing at it. Making a joke often changes the dynamics of things. Seize the moral initiative somehow. Refuse to submit or to accept the inferior position. Expose the injustice of the system. Shame the oppressor into repentance. Be willing to suffer rather than retaliate. Whoa, there's a big one. Die to the fear of the old order and its rules. And from this one, take control of the power dynamics. Try and change the power thing around. They may be your boss, but you're powerful as well in a different kind of way. Try and change the power dynamics. Stand your ground. Most bullies, most people that use power, want to intimidate. If you stand your ground somehow, in a non-violent, non-aggressive way, but be present to the other person, that can be a very powerful, changing thing for the situation that's around. Make the powers make decisions for which they're not prepared. Recognize your own power and seek the oppressor's transformation. So here are a number of things. Sorry about the small font, but it was the only way I could fit it onto one slide. So if you're at the back, you might need binoculars. So here are a number of things that we can do that will bring this teaching of Jesus that was relevant 2,000 years ago into our day and age. We're not going to do all of these things, but we might do some of these things in different situations that can just change a situation of conflict that could escalate and that we could become peacemakers. And I just want to finish, and then we're going to sing, with just some thoughts around, there is a fourth one that we're about to go on to. Don't know if we'll do it next time or if we'll just have a little pause. I'll see. Next time's beginning of December. The next verse in this has often been read, I believe, out of context. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. I want to suggest that the next verse is actually all about conflict. That's the context in which it's found in. It's all about peacemaking. But there is a difference between the next one, and we'll look at that next time. Maybe you want to ask yourself, what does that verse mean in the context of peacemaking and conflict? Give to the one who asks of you. Do not refuse the one who wants to borrow from you. But there is a difference. And one of the things that binds the last three that we've looked at, turn the other cheek, give your cloak as well, go the extra mile, is the situations where the you is. When someone strikes you on the right cheek, if someone wants to sue you the you in these three scenarios are all very powerless. There is a powerlessness that is assumed in these three situations. You are the slave. You are the one in the debtor's court. You are the one that is oppressed by the invading and occupying armies of Rome. You are always powerless in these situations. Let's just turn to Matthew chapter 25, I think it is, just as we finish here and then the band are going to come. And I believe that there is a place in recognizing our powerlessness that we can actually change the world. So when Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane in Matthew, it's Matthew chapter 26 actually. He's about to be arrested. And it says in verse 50, the men stepped forward and seized Jesus and arrested him. With that, one of Jesus' companions reached for his sword, drew it out and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. And then here's what Jesus says. Put your sword back in its place, Jesus said to him. For all who draw the sword die by the sword. In some translations it say, all who live by the sword die by the sword. If you go that way of violence, violence and conflict breed violence and conflict. Breed violence and conflict. If we live by the sword, we'll die by the sword. And then I think there's this extraordinary statement that Jesus makes. Do you not think I cannot call on my Father, and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? You see, Jesus actually isn't the powerless one in this situation. But Jesus chose that path of powerlessness. He chose the path of powerlessness because actually he realized that not meeting violence with violence would actually bring peace. He chose the path of powerlessness. He chose the path of powerlessness because he knew that walking that path would first be the crucial, most important thing that might bring peace between human beings and God. He chose that path of powerlessness because it is walking that path of powerlessness that somehow we can find a power that is a different kind of power, that is not a power of violence or position or aggression or any of those kinds of violences, but it is a power that exists within every single human being that can actually change the dynamics of relationships. It's a powerlessness. It's a refusal to use the power of this world of swords and armies and violence and aggression, knowing that that powerlessness that Jesus chose to walk down meant that he ended up on the cross, died, beaten, battered. But actually, in that place of powerlessness, he accomplished the greatest victory that we could possibly ever imagine. And Jesus invites us to walk down the path of powerlessness. We may not find ourselves in a situation where we're the slave, where we are in a place of being occupied by foreign armies, where we are in a debtor's court where we only own two things. But he invites us to walk down that path of powerlessness. He invites us to lay aside the power that we might have through our money or our position or through our eloquence with wise and clever words. He invites us to walk down a different path to make peace with people, to break cycles of violence and conflict, and to show that there is a different way. And on this day that we remember those who died in war, and I think it is right to do so, I believe we also as the church need to say there is a different and there is a better way. And our hope is not for war, but for peace. And our hope is for a world where peace has come, but peace has not come through violence and warfare, through sending armies and planes and people dying in conflict. Our hope is for a peace that comes through the powerlessness of Jesus' cross and people who follow Jesus that way, who choose to lay down our rights to walk that path of powerlessness that will change the dynamics. In my own life, I know that I have some relationships that have fallen apart. But I also know that there's relationships where there's been significant conflict, but we've worked it through. And when we've worked it through, it's because the place of working it through has mainly been because I have somehow learned how to find my own place, my own part in the conflict. Rather than finger wagging and blaming other people, it's to lay aside our own rights, to lay aside our own rightness, to walk that path of powerlessness, to aim for peace. And that's the hope that we have. And I'd just like to invite Joel. Thanks, Joel. Can we just sing as we come to an end just this morning? I believe Rob Bell's done this series of talks on somewhat similar material, and he called it Calling All Peacemakers. And I just thought, that's brilliant. Why didn't I think of that? And I nearly called it Calling All Peacemakers as a shameless plagiarism on Rob Bell's thing. But I do actually believe that God is calling all peacemakers. I do believe God is looking for people who courageously walk the path of peacemaking, not of being doormats and not violently asserting their own rights and power over other people, but going this third way. And I believe Jesus is looking for peacemakers, people who would say, now and in the rest of our lives, God, we want to work for peace. And so as we sing this, I just want to invite you in some way to respond to God. It might be by standing, it might be by kneeling, it might be by raising your hands, it might be by saying something to God personally, it might be bringing a situation of conflict before Him, but I just want to invite you to respond to God somehow. Because I believe He's calling all peacemakers. He's looking for people who would courageously make peace, which is just as costly as making war. So if you want to stand as we sing this, if you want to kneel, if you want to raise your hands, if you want to go and kneel by the cross, just do something, but respond to God in whatever way is meaningful for you. Let's take it away, Joel, and then we'll close this morning.